Thank you very much, Sabine, for introduction you made, and also thank you very much for inviting me to give a talk here, which is basically been kind of the work I have done the last about 5 years I put together to give you some information about the magnetic field of Mars and the first thing is that I'll just show you the size between the Mars and Earth. You can feel some scale on that. Mars is about 1/10 of the Earth as far as this volume or mass is concerned. But it's the next door neighbor to us, and we always know that the grass of the neighbor is always greener than ours. So we like to go and see it. And one of the things that is important is that we have lived in our planet, blue planet, for about 40,000 centuries. We have lived here. And I believe, this is my belief, that we are going to live in this orange planet in the next 2 centuries. I have some evidence for that, or I have something to support that my suggestions. This is all of the missions which has been attempted to go to Mars from 1960s to up to today. And the cross-star bombs which are failed, non-cross-star bombs which are successful. Once it is successful, it is really good. It gives huge amount of data. For example, one of them, which I am going to show the results today, is a Mars Global Surveyor, has been successful. It should have been there only for 2 years. Now it's about 8 years, and they're working very nicely. The same thing goes with the two rovers. That they should have been there about 3-4 months. Now it's about 3 years they are working. It's beautiful that this happens. Another thing I would like you to see from here that backs my suggestion of going there in 200 years or within the 2 centuries, the rate of the success. As we go close and close, we have more success here than there, and it seems that it's a kind of exponential in a way. So the more technology we get, the better we can have a chance to go to Mars. I also have another evidence, which I think is more important than this, shows that we are really going to go there. So Tim Horton already started to advertise that.
That means
that
Canada gets there first,
doesn't it?
That means that Canada gets there first.
Yes. But by the way, Tim Horton is no longer Canadian. It is bought by Americans. Anyhow. Before I go, let me just orient you about Mars. This is the topography of Mars. As you see, the Mars is basically a dichotomy. It has a dichotomy. Northern part is lowlands, and southern parts are highlands. And there are a few major features which I will discuss about them, or I will mention, which I would like to show here. One of them is this big bulge that's called Tharsis Bulge. This is about 6,000 kilometers, 4,000 kilometers diameter, and in the average height of about 8 kilometers. It's a very big bulge there on top of the Mars. There's a canyon there. This canyon called Valles Marineris is a very big canyon. It's about 2,000 kilometer length. Some places it goes about 800 kilometers wide, and some places it goes about 8 kilometers down depth. You can put more than 1,000 Grand Canyon inside this canyon. Just give you some feeling about that one. Another one which I will talk about is these basins. This is one, that's one, that's one, and this one. Hellas, Isidis, Argyle, and Christie. These are, or there are other basins here that we cannot see it in the topographic map. These are buried. But these are the impacts, very big impacts produce these basins. And this basin, for example, that one is about diameter, is about 25 kilometers, 2,500 kilometers. These are a little bit smaller ones. The last thing I would like to mention here is this chain of mountains, and especially this mountain here called Mount Olympus. That's the largest mountain in our solar system. Its diameter is about 600 kilometers from Toronto to Montreal. And its height is about 25 kilometers. So it is 3 times bigger than what the Himalayas, if you want to. Well, as I said, the Global Surveyor was the one which launched in 1997, and there were many scientific goals, but one of them was about the existence of the magnetic field. If I were here about 1996 and I was trying to tell you about the magnetic field of Mars, it wouldn't take more than about a couple of minutes. I would say there's no magnetic field. And the estimate that people had given was less than 10% of the magnetic field of the Earth. So that was the time we were thinking, but that's why one of the payloads they put in was magnetometer to see if they can measure the magnetic field of Mars. And this satellite went much closer to the Mars. Sometimes it goes as close as about 100 kilometer altitude. So based on that one, and for the first time, before going there, the satellite had two kind of orbits. Originally, it was very elliptical orbits, and that's what brought sometimes much closer to the Mars' surface. But later on, after about a year and a half, they aerobrake and put them almost in a circular orbit of about altitude of 400 kilometers. And this is, as you see, that the high altitude data is huge. It really covers everywhere, and distance between two tracks and the average distance is about 5 kilometers or 6 kilometers. Huge amount of data. But the low altitude data has lots of gaps. Therefore, this is a little bit difficult to work with. I'm going to work with this one. I have worked with this one lots. This is the first map of the magnetic field of Mars, which was published by NASA. And this is historically very important. They took the... Am I correct if I do like this? No. Oh, okay. I want to go backward. Sorry.
This one to go
okay. Back. Okay. That's good. Okay. They use this data, this low altitude data, to calculate that one. And the low altitude data had the very, very high variations of the vertical distances. And they didn't do any kind of corrections. They just wanted to show that there is a magnetic field. It was very important from that point of view. And that's why they have not done any kind of altitude corrections for this one. What you see here basically is that major anomalies are in the southern hemisphere. Northern hemisphere, which was the lowlands and smooth places, has almost no magnetic anomalies. And also, I will show you later on a little bit better, that's the Hellas Basin I was showing you, and this is the Argar Basin, and the same as the Isidis Basin. They don't have any magnetic anomalies. So there may be some relationship how the impact basins lost their magnetization. So I'm going to talk about that one a little bit. So the presentation outline will be this: magnetic anomalies of Mars, how we drive it, what's the global interpretation of the anomalies, and then what's the source of the magnetic anomalies. This is the kind of things I am doing the last 3-4 years, trying to understand what could be the magnetic sources. One of the reasons is that magnetic anomalies of Mars are 10 to 100 times stronger than the magnetic field of the Earth's crust. That's one thing. Another thing is that Mars has no core field. Therefore, what we see is a remnant magnetization, which is blocked or locked on the crust since we think that is since about 4 billion years ago. And I have some evidence for that. Well, I cannot say anything about my work until I tell who are the contributors. These two are my graduate students, and Pandit was my undergraduate student. Now he's a graduate student at the University of Washington. And he was my, Dr. Shahnaz was my research associate here. And also very many people in whole NASA, Europe, here, and U.S., that they are working on Mars, and I have taken all of the information from them, and I am not going to reference each one by one by one. So we just take it as a global understanding of us, what we understand about Mars. So I will look at the high-altitude magnetic data, which is acquired between 1999 to 2003. This is about 4 years of data I am analyzing. And each time there was a flux gate magnetometer, so measured all three components of the magnetic field. So we have all the three components of the magnetic field. There are a huge amount of data, as I said, and a given measurement is made of the crustal field, plus the magnetic field due to the external sources like ionosphere, magnetosphere, plus solar wind, magnetic field, plus some noise. Noise could be due to the instrument noise or data processing noise, basically. But the noise is very small. However, external field and internal field are important. We have to be able to separate them. In order to separate them, and I am interested in the crustal field, if I have to remove somehow the external field. One thing we do is that we only take the data which is acquired at night time. The orbit was sun synchronous. It measures at 2 p.m. and 2 a.m. So I take all the data in the 2 a.m. part. It reduces lots of the effects of the solar wind and all of those things. It doesn't go to zero, but it reduces lots. The second thing I do, because of huge amount of data, I separate the data to two parts, like 2 years first and the next 2 years. And from each one, I model them in terms of spherical harmonics, so I get two maps, and I correlate them together. And the most repeatable features, I think that they should be coming from crust. So I do covariance analysis to do that. So the final map will be the most repeatable one. It doesn't mean that it does not have any non-crustal things. It may have, but should be very, very small after all of these tedious selection rules that I use. This is the altitude variations of the satellite. Those two sets of maps, one of them two sets of data, as I said, one of them is red, one of them is black. And what you see basically is that altitude varies by about 70 kilometers. So it goes from about 360 to 430 about a kilometer from north to south. That's one thing is important. Therefore, if you really want to make a model, it's better to take that one into account because that's very important for low resolution part or the short wavelength components of the data, which deteriorates much faster within that 70 kilometers. Well, what you do basically, this is the only mathematics I am putting here for you people. What you do, you take the data, this is the data as r theta phi, basically, at a given point, and you expand that one in spherical harmonics, and you assume that the magnetic potential is internal, therefore it should go like 1 over r to power n plus 1. N is the degree of the harmonics, m is the order of the harmonics, y and m is the fully normalized harmonic coefficients, and v and m is the complex coefficients of the harmonics. That's what basically we do. So, knowing the potential, we should know the force or magnetic field, and therefore this is the model. I fit the model to the to observed ones. So BR, BFR will be the difference between the R component, theta component, and phi component. One of the important things is that although we have three components, R component is less noisy than the other ones. So much, much better. Therefore, I used only R component of the data rather than the other ones. Therefore, I only used that part. So you do the least square technique. From that one, you calculate all of the VNMs. Once you have the VNMs, then you can look at the power spectrum, which waves have more strong power or not. And also, if you have two maps, which I have two maps, then you can do kind of degree correlations, find out which degree of this map and which degree of this map they correlate together. So the covariance is that I take all of the harmonics which have positive correlations. But the ones which are negative correlation cannot be crustal because one of them says the positive and another one says negative. That cannot be crustal because crustal field doesn't change in time, at least within the times that we are looking for. Well, this is two maps. Is HA1, HA2 is the high altitude data 1, data 2. This is the model. And after fitting the models, this is the residuals of the fit. I think that the residuals are very, very small. And notice that the residuals are mainly north-south oriented, is along the orbits of the planet, of the satellite. Therefore, this kind of covariance analysis which I do, it removes all of this kind of noise. People have done this kind of things before, and this shows the power spectrum of the data, and so this is the degree of the harmonics, and the log 10 of power. I have put many models here. The CNN is the model from Americans, NASA. Jia is my model, and Ken is the Ken et al.'s model from Florida. Those three models are based on kind of things I was doing it, like fitted the model and calculated the coefficients. But there were two other models coming, one from NASA. Both of them comes from NASA, but the other one also people from England they are included on that. These two models, they don't do that. They first calculate the source function, and then from source function they calculate the magnetic field. By doing this one, they have to remove lots of the high frequencies because of their singularity or because of the instability of the thing. That's why if you look at theirs, the higher harmonics are not so well preserved. Based on these three models, it seems that up to about degree N65, the models are almost identical. Beyond that, they are changing, and they are changing differently also. Not only they are different, but the structure also is different. So it means that this part cannot be crustal. So the model which I am thinking, or I have suggested, is that the model which up to about degree 65 is crustal, and the rest are not crustal. Okay, what kind of resolution we are really looking at? This is the one which I showed to you, and the question is that suppose that it's a big blob there of negative as an example. Does it mean that big blob of means that there is a big source which has negative magnetization? Well, the answer is may not be the case. Just to show you that, I do this one. This is a magnetic map of eastern Canada. Just give you some feeling. That's the Labrador Sea. And this is the Angaba Bay. This is that part will be, this part will be here, will be bay. Okay? So we are in eastern Canada. And this is the magnetic map at the surface almost, about 300 meters up. What you see basically, there are lots of negative anomalies. And this negative anomaly, for example, this one as an example, is a suture zone or collision between two continents. Happened about 0.9 billion years ago. That's the Greenville front. So you can see that collision kind of reduces the magnetization. The same thing goes this one. This one comes from there like this. That's a collision happened about 1.4 billion years ago. Okay, again, you can see that the effects. The same thing goes this one. It's also another collision. So collisions of this kind of continent collisions together and so produces this kind of thing. If you take this model, this map, this data, this is the data, and upward continent to about 100 kilometer altitude. In other words, if you assume that you are going to measure this one at 100 kilometer altitude, you can see this one. So you can see that at 100 kilometer altitude, you lose all of these little things, but you keep that kind of long features, which is the suture zones. That one and that one. So at 100 kilometer, you still see the regional tectonics. But you don't see any kind of local things. Now, if you go to 400 kilometer, just like high altitude of Mars, okay, what you see is this one. I'd like you to remember that this is the kind of things that they are looking. Oops. I think I made a mistake again. Which one is that?
This one.
I did that one twice, but okay. All right, thank you. Okay, that's good. I do one small. So, these anomalies that we see may not be really big anomalies, but made of many, many small features. This is the magnetic anomaly map of radial component based on harmonics of degree 65. This is the most repeatable ones. Instead, I have two maps for the covariance analysis and then average those two covariant bars, and this is a magnetic map. And what you see basically, again, the magnetic anomalies are in the southern hemisphere, and lower hemisphere has a very small magnetic anomalies. There's no magnetic anomaly associated with these mountains. That mountain is a basaltic. If it were happened on Earth, that would be one of the biggest magnetic anomalies. It doesn't have it. It means that this formed in the absence of the core field. Core field was not there at the time this was full. There's another one like this one. This is a Hellas Basin. Hellas, you see this? There's Argyris and Christie here. It seems that the Hellas Basin was magnetic before, as you see from the surrounding, but this impact has demagnetized it. So I will talk about the magnetization of the impacts that happened. Another thing I would like you to see is this Grand Canyon. This is a kind of very big canyon there. This canyon, well, if the Tharsis balls, those basaltic flows which produce the Tharsis balls, if they were magnetic, if you cut them up and open up, they will show edge effects. You have to see the magnetic edge effects. And you don't see it. There's no edge effects. It means that these rocks formed again in the absence of the core field. Does that give some idea about when the core field was there? So it should be, it was before this, before that, but it was there maybe during this impact or not later. Because if this impact formed and produced lots of heat and that, and demagnetized, if they were core, they would have been magnetized again. But it hasn't magnetized. Therefore, the core field was not there also at the time of this impact. So timing of the core dynamo comes from this lowlands, no impact basin anomalies, no anomalies with the shields, and no anomalies with the Valles Marineris. Tells me that it should be older than all of these features, core field. We have also another way to measure or to estimate the core field is the coming from the Mars meteorites. And among the Mars meteorites, there's only one which is magnetized, and that's the oldest. It's about 4.5 billion years old, but the magnetization happened about 4.2 billion years ago. That has a magnetic field. But it's a very weak magnetic field, and it can be magnetized. We think that it's magnetized in the field of about 10% of the magnetic field of the Earth. So the core field could be about 10% of that. Oh, could be a little bit more, we do not know what. But that just gives some idea about the size of the core. So what we understand from it, we have very strong magnetization, should be, to produce the magnetic anomalies. We need to have a magnetization about 10 times or to about 100 times stronger than the magnetization of the crustal rocks on Earth. So it can be, this strong magnetization can be due to many things. Could be strong magnetic field of the core, or due to the thick magnetic layer, or due to the concentration of high magnetic particles in the crust, or due to the particles which are highly magnetic. So those are four different sources which could produce very strong magnetic anomalies. And I'm going to talk each one of them as much as I could. First, the strength of the core field. The core field can be the magnetic field in the core of the Earth or any planets can be estimated from two ways we usually use. It's either called the energy balance method, which balances the gravitational energy released due to the cooling and the ohmic energy was dissipated. This estimate is very unconstrained. Why? Because it depends on the thermal evolution of the core, which is extremely unconstrained. So it's very difficult to estimate magnetic field from that one. Another one is by magnetoestrophic. It means that you balance the Coriolis force with the Lorentz force. This gives us a formula, something like that, which omega is the rate of rotation, rho is the density, mu zero is the magnetic permeability. L is the characteristic length of the media, like the diameter of the core, as an example, and U is the characteristic length, like characteristic velocity. In the case of Mars, the L is about 1,500 kilometers, the radius, compared to the Earth is about 3,400 kilometers. And assuming that this omega is similar to the Earth, and the rho is, the Earth is a little bit more than Mars, and mu zero, I assume that the same, and I assume that even if you have the same characteristic velocities, we think that the velocities on Mars may be a little bit lower because of a smaller body, but let's say it is that. And based on that one, we come up with the idea that core field of Mars should be on the order of about 50% of the core field of the Earth, or comparable to the core field of the Earth, basically. But there's also another factor, is that once you know the core field, at the core, at the core mental boundary or inside the core, that field decays as it comes to the surface. That decay factor goes like 1 over r to power n plus 2. N is the degree of harmonics. For example, if n equals to 1, means the dipole goes like that to power 3. So due to this decay also, the magnetic field of Mars's core decays faster as it comes to the surface of Mars than the magnetic field of the Earth by a factor of about 2. Therefore, from this kind of estimate, there's a suggestion, or we come to the feeling, that the magnetic field of Mars cannot be very strong. May not have been very strong than the magnetic field of the Earth, or maybe even weaker than that. The another one is the thickness of the magnetic layer. Can we have a very thick magnetic layer on Mars to produce the magnetic anomalies? The average magnetic layer on Earth, and there's a continent, is about 40 kilometers, 40, 35, 40 kilometers. So can we make that one to be 400 kilometers or something like that, so that you could have what? Strong magnetic anomalies by a factor of 10. Well, that depends on the thermal state of the Martian crust at the time of the core dynamo, and also what kind of material you have as a magnetic material. Usually people talk about magnetite, hematite, and pyrotite. And I would like you to see their core temperatures. Pyrotite is very, very low core temperature. So if pyrotite is the one, it should have much thinner crust than the other ones. Okay. To calculate the temperature inside the crust, we have to look at two ways of how the Mars evolved. One possibility is that in the very early, there was a plate tectonics on Mars. Another one was that, no, we had never plate tectonics. It was always standing lead. If we had a plate tectonics, the plate was formed and subducted. If this is fast enough, it will not cool fast enough. Therefore, the magnetic layer, which is the depth to the core temperature, will be thinner. On the other hand, if the crust is stagnant, it could stay there and cool faster and will be thicker. Therefore, usually, if the plate tectonics happen, it should produce thinner magnetic layer. And stagnant layer will be thicker magnetic layer. Let us take the maximum one, so we will look at the stagnant lead convection. To calculate stagnant lead convection inside Mars, you can do two ways. One is to solve the convection equations. Another one is just do some kind of simulations. I believe that the results of those two will not be so much important in the upper, say, stagnant lead of the Earth, in the crust of the Mars. So the difference will not be so big. Secondly, the physical parameters which goes in the equations of the convection has much, much more wider uncertainties, like what's the viscosity of the mantle of Mars. So the errors due to those uncertainties is much bigger than the difference between those two simulations or convection calculations. So that's why I took the simulation one and looked at many, many things. Simulations that you just basically do the energy balance in the core, whatever is energy formed there, plus the cooling goes out of the core, and the energy balance in the mantle, whatever comes from the core, plus whatever is produced by the radioactive elements inside the mantle, can be two parts. One raises the temperature of the mantle, and the rest goes out of the mantle, basically. That's what basically it is. So we also look at the idea that heat goes like conduction in the upper and lower boundary of the mantle, which is called thermal boundary layers. And we also look at temperature and pressure dependent viscosity. Viscosity cannot be Newtonian, could be non-Newtonian, so it can be temperature pressure dependent. We take that into account. Time variations of the temperature in the stagnant lead, since I'm using the stagnant lead, you have to be very careful. It's not a constant temperature at the bottom. It changes in time. Take that one, and also pressure-dependent thermal expansion. Thermal expansion changes by a factor of about 2 to 5 inside the Earth's mantle. And so it could be that changes also in the mantle of Mars. So also temperature dependent thermal conductivity and time dependent of the heat sources. Radioactive elements decay in time, therefore their heats are what? Time dependent. So I take all of them into account. So the thermal evolution, I did in this one, 23 thermal evolution models, and the parameters I have looked at it was the thickness of the initial crust, how much was the initial crust to start with, total heat generation in the and its concentration, the mantle and the crust, initial temperature of the mantle, viscosity of the mantle, thermal expansion coefficients, as I said. And there's one other thing that people think that. They suggest that it's possible that when the core was formed, the gravitational energy of the formation of the core is not really paired with the mantle. Therefore, the core was formed at superheated conditions. And the people talk about the core maybe is hotter by about 300 degrees than calculations made by equilibrium calculations. So I take that one to be a superheated core. And heat generation in the core, sometimes people think that there is a heat generation in the core because of the possibly potassium in the core. I take all of them also into account. So I use 23 thermal evolution models. This is the temperature distribution inside one of them. It's in the lithosphere as a function of time. You can see that initially I have about lithosphere above 200 kilometers and temperature is linearly increasing. That's initial conditions. But as time passes, first of all, lithosphere thickens. And temperature of here gets lower and this part gets higher a little bit. That's the initial temperature distribution or evolution of the temperature distribution within the first 500 million years. And based on the idea that I told you, we believe that the core dynamo was there only for the first about 500 million years. So I'm just looking at the word, that first 500 million years. And this shows the variations of magnetic layer. What's the thickness of the magnetic layer? Based on this thermal evolution model, that this is just one model. It depends on whether you have hematite, magnetite, or pyrrhotite. The thickness of the magnetic layer for hematite and magnetite is on the order of about 100 kilometers, not more. And if it is pyrrhotite, it will be about 50 kilometers. So at most, is that much. I'll give you one other thing. This is the 23 models I have used for to calculate the depth to the core temperature or the thickness of the magnetic layer. You can see that again for hematite and magnetite, which are these, is about 100 kilometers. For pyrrhotite, it's about 50 kilometers. So any kind of thermal evolution calculations you make with all of the parameters you choose, the thickness of the magnetic layer may not be more than about 100 kilometers. Thickness of the magnetic layer of the Earth is about 40 kilometers, so this could add only by a factor of 2 and not by a factor of 100 or 10. So this may not be the source either. The third one is the concentration of magnetic minerals. How much magnetic minerals do we have in Mars? Of course, Mars's crust has more iron. That's why Mars's surface is brown. However, the magnetic particles in the crust depends on the oxidation state of the iron, and not the total iron. And we do not know anything about that. So this is a very big open question. How much iron is there in the crust, in the upper, say, 100 kilometers, 40, 50 kilometers of the crust, and what's the oxidation stage that they could produce oxides, iron oxides, which are magnetic? So that is an interesting thing that for basically petrology people that to try to see they can get some feeling about that. Another one, as I said, is that do we have any kind of material which are highly magnetic? Well, this shows the magnetic magnetization of magnetite, and these are hematite, these two, as a function of the grain size. So these are the very, very small grains. And then you go, there is a bit higher, thicker grains. Very, very small grains, which is called single domains. And magnetite is highly magnetic, extremely magnetic, whereas hematite is not. So it means that if you could produce magnetite by some kind of procedures which produces a single domain, that's the best thing to do. Okay? Otherwise, if you want to go to produce at a much slower rate, like in the deeper part of the crust, then this will be produced lots of multi-domain magnetite is not good magnetic. However, it is possible that you could produce multi-domain hematite. That could be magnetic, high magnetic. But it's still the difference between this hematite, multi-domain hematite, and single-domain magnetite is about a factor of 10. So still, the winning game will be if you could get to this one, if it is possible. So, single-domain magnetite can be produced in one way. If you have a cross and there's intrusion, an intrusive rocks there, intrusive rock cools very slowly, and it always produces multi-domain particles. Therefore, intrusion rocks cannot produce that kind of magnetization we need. Maybe extrusive rocks can do it. Because extrusive rocks, they're volcanoes, they come out when cool very fast and chills and produce a single-domain magnetite. So it can be produced, a single-domain magnetite can be produced during the initial rapid cooling of lava. And there are two other mechanisms, at least, that you can produce single-domain by. One is by taking the oxygen solution of titanium magnetite. This one is integral magnetic bodies. They are much bigger magnetites, but since they are elongated, they behave like a single-domain magnetite. So from that point of view, it's good. But there's another one just recently published that they looked at the basaltic olivines. So olivine basalts. And they find that this can produce single-domain magnetite. So since that there is a chance that in a lava which is cooling very fast, it's possible to produce single-domain magnetite. Well, do we have any evidence that we have lots of volcanic things? First of all, Mars, lots of petrologists believe that has been, from the beginning, a stagnant lead or one-plate planet. If there's a one-plate planet, the crust can form one way is from the bottom, but majorly comes from up and produces as the volcanoes. A very good example that the Tarsus bulge I told you, that very big bulge, based on the topography and gravity on that bulge, the people suggest that they are about 20 to 30 kilometer thick basaltic extrusives. Basaltic volcanoes produce that. So there's a chance that a part of the crust, upper say about 30, 40, 50 kilometers of the crust, is formed gradually within the first about 500 million years by volcanism. If that's the case, it means that each lava comes there and cools fast, and then another one comes on top of it like that goes up. So I looked at that idea. So cooling of the lava, so I take a lava initially put on the surface at the molten lava, basically, and let it cool there, and as it cools, it passes through the cooling temperature and calculate its magnetization. So the way you do the thermal calculation, because the lavas are much thinner, there won't be any big convection going on there. It will be basically conduction. So we solve the conduction equations, and different values I used it, but it's not so important. But it's that I have looked at all of the possible variations of the physical parameters of this kind of lava. Okay. Well, the conditions are very simple. At the surface, temperature is zero. At the bottom of the lava, temperature should be equal to the temperature of the crust. And now, as this cools, crust gets warmer, of course. So you look at the all thermal evolution models. And how this crust is formed, how the lavas come on top of each other, people think that it comes like exponentially, slowly, it grows basically, and therefore I can look at each one and put another one, but with some kind of relaxation time of this growth rate. So I took that one also into consideration. This is just one as an example. This is not the real, that may not happen. I have taken a lava of about 250 meters at the liquid temperature. I put it at the top of the crust, but the crust or lithosphere was very hot, by the way. It was initially at the liquidist temperature of peridotite. It's a very hot one. But as you see, as time passes, these are the numbers are the years after putting the lavas. You can see that at the beginning it's very high and temperature of lava, but as time passes, the temperature of the lava goes away, and after about 1,000 years, it becomes just simple regular geotherm kind of things that we have. So it doesn't really take a long time to cool lavas, especially if the lavas are very small or thin. This shows the thermal evolution of the 30 meters thick lava, and this is the thickness of the lava, that's the time goes like that. Initially you put lava there as a molten layer, and you let it cool as time passes. As you can see, after a little bit of time, it becomes almost geotherm. So beyond that is simple geotherm calculations that people can do. This shows you the temperature at the middle of the lava, depending on the thickness of the lava. As you see, if the lava is thinner, about 10 meters, it cools much faster than 30 meters and 50 meters. Usually, lavas on Earth, like if you go to Hawaii, is about 2 or 3 meters thickness, each one. So maybe the Mars was like that also. They were even, the Mars could have cooled much, much faster than this. The bottom line is here, is just that if upper part of the crust of Mars is formed by lavas, the lavas cooled very, very fast and basically chilled. And then they start to warm up because of the burial. Another one comes on top of it and this has to heat it up. This is, shows the growth of the crust, as I said, is exponential. And also I have looked many, many models, and some of them, the crust starts right at the beginning, about 4.6 billion years ago, but some of them starts after 100 million years after that. So I'm looking at the different setting of the formation of the crust, and this shows a different exponential of the growth of the crust. These are the same thing. What I like to show here is that although we have many different, I hope I will be right this time, yes. Although we have many different growth rates, as you see, different crust formed at different times and different crust rate, growth rate, but as the lava deepens, the first lava deepens because of the stacking of the other lavas, as the first lava deepens, its temperature at the middle, temperature at the middle of the first lava, so that the temperature of all of them comes to the same thing on the order of here at about 35, 40 kilometers. So no matter what you initial lava you are taking, they all of them cool to the conditions of about 30, 40 kilometers. They are similar. And also the 30, 40 kilometer is the Curie temperature of magnetite. So what does this mean is that it is possible to keep the single domain magnetite, which is formed right at the surface on the lava, and then the lava, of course, deepened. That could remain single domain and remain magnetic up to above depth of about 30 to 40 kilometers. So it means that the upper 30 to 40 kilometers of Mars could have single domain magnetite and therefore very highly magnetic material. Well, that's the way we are thinking. Now, the question is that what we measure today comes from two parts. One is what was the magnetization 4 billion years ago, which I was showing you before, up to now. And then what happened since? Since that, many, many things happened. And then they have changed the magnetization of the crust. And usually they tend to reduce the magnetization. So, change the magnetization of the crust. The factors are, one is the hydrothermal magnetization. In the case of the Earth, the oceanic lavas, which are formed at the mid-ocean regions, they lose their magnetization as time passes. And if you look at the results, they find out that magnetization decreases by about a factor of 4 within the first 20 million years. But then, from then on, it stays as it is. So the oceanic rocks remains under the water for about 200 million years. Their magnetization doesn't change. It changes only in the first about 20 million years. So in the case of Mars, what is the thickness of the upper crust, which could have hydrothermal conditions? It depends on the thickness of the cracks and how much cracks are there. Well, we have no idea about Mars, but we have some idea about the Moon. From the seismic data on the Moon, they find out that the upper about 25 kilometers of the Moon is cracked. It's called mega regolith. And below that it is not, because at higher depth it will be higher pressure and the cracks seal. If you take that 25 kilometers of the Moon and scale that one to the gravity of Mars, gravity of Mars is a factor of 2 almost, more than the moon. That scaling goes like 1 over, goes like 1 over gravity, of course. Therefore, the thickness of the crack layer of Mars could be not more than about 12 to 13 kilometers. So if there is any kind of demagnetization or reduction of the magnetization, must happen in the upper about 10 kilometers. Another one is the impacts. If you have a very huge impact, it produces a shock pressure. This is an impact which produces a crater of 200 kilometer diameter, radius, sorry, and this shows the pressure inside the crust due to that impact. And people looked at it and say that if you shock the rocks, magnetic rocks, at a pressure of about 2 to 3 gigapascal, it loses its magnetization. Therefore, if you look at this one, should be so this will be the part which is demagnetized by this. So demagnetization by the impact, and is there any kind of things? Yes, this is the one. For example, you can see that this is the Hellas Basin, Christie, Argyle, and this is, those are two different curves due to two different scaling laws we have used, but it says that this scaling law says that based on the pressure of the impact, that part should be demagnetized. And it seems that it's demagnetized. In fact, it's demagnetized more than whatever is given by the scaling laws. So these are the demagnetized parts. However, there's one interesting thing is that if you take them to smaller craters, these are craters of about 300 kilometer diameter, they are not demagnetized. They don't demagnetize the crust. It's interesting. So the crust is not demagnetized by small craters, but it's demagnetized by larger ones. So it tells me that the magnetic source should be at deeper parts, not near the surface, because these should demagnetize, based on the scaling laws, should demagnetize up for about 10 to 20 kilometers, and they have not. It means that the source body is not within the upper 20 kilometers. Could be at deeper parts of the Earth. There's one other thing that I will just say this one and finish this. But one other possibility is that you produce the magnetization of the upper crust in the time of the core formation. But the lower part of the crust is hot, and therefore it doesn't get magnetized during the core dynamo. But it could get colder and colder in later time, and past the Curie temperature, in the presence of the magnetic field of the upper layer. This was the thing that I looked at it in about 2002, and I looked at the idea that you put a layer there, magnetized, and then the lower layer starts to cool, and how much the lower layer gets magnetized by the magnetic field of the upper layer, and forget the things. And what you see here basically is this is the magnetization of the upper layer. These are R theta phi component of the magnetization, R theta phi component of the spherical harmonic, spherical coordinate composition of the magnetic field, magnetization of the upper layer, and this is the magnetization of the first lower layer just adjacent to the crust. So you can see that these are not really very big things. So the magnetic field of Mars may not be due to the secondary magnetization happening later on, but due to the initial magnetization. Well, I want to go through this. And then let me just give you one last one, is the viscous decay. If you take a rock and magnetize it, say take a rock and magnetize, say, Curie temperature about 500 degrees, and then put this rock at 300 degrees at zero magnetic field. It will not keep its magnetization. Its magnetization decays in time. That's called viscous magnetization. So you can look at that one. For example, in this case, it's a magnetite. If you have a magnetite, which is magnetized at this one, say about 760 degree Kelvin, and if you keep that one at about 620, 30 Kelvin for about 1 billion years, it gets demagnetized. Therefore, if the lower part of the crust, which are magnetized by the core dynamo, but it stays there for 4 billion years at a high temperature, then it may decay in its magnetization. This kind of things that we looked at it, that the crust we took was about, I took the 100 kilometer thick magnetic layer, and depending on whether you do magnetite, hematite, or pyrotite. And this is a very good example is the magnetite. The initial part from there to there is 100% magnetic. And from there to there is 100% non-magnetic. Within between there is a partial magnetization because the magnetite has a blocking temperature range of about 100 kilometers. So that's why you get a little bit more magnetic hard there than that. But this crust is subject to the thermal evolution, and it's the thermal evolution of that crust. And due to this thermal evolution, that part of the crust gets demagnetized. Therefore, this crust, which was like this, today is something like that. So this is today, and that's initially. So there is some demagnetization, but demagnetization is not so big, on the order of about 5-4 kilometers. So viscous demagnetization does not have a very big effect. So I like to conclude that the core dynamo is formed about 4 billion years ago. The core field of Mars was basically, the core field was small or comparable to the Earth's. Therefore, that cannot be the source of the strong magnetization of the Mars. The crust, the magnetic layer of Mars may not be much bigger than the magnetic layer of the Earth, thicker than that. So that cannot be. One thing that I have never looked at it, and I think that petrologists look at, is that how much iron do we have and what's the oxidation stage of iron in the core, in the crust of Mars. That we do not know it. But the other one which I looked at is what is the possibility that single domain particles can be in the upper about 20, 30, 40 kilometers of Mars. It shows that if you take the lavas and cool it, it's possible that the upper about 40 kilometers of Mars can have single domain magnetite. Can have. I am not saying it has. It can have. If that single domain magnetite is produced at the time of the formation of the lavas or at the chilling time of the lava. Well, the other things are not so big. Is that low temperature hydration may not decrease by more than about 10 kilometers of the upper parts. And impact demagnetization, if the impact is very big, yes, demagnetizes all of the crust, like big basins. But if it is small, it does not. So upper 10 kilometers, either due to this phenomena or any other things, or very small impacts which randomize, upper about 10 to 15 kilometers may not be even magnetic so much. And thermal evolution of basaltic lavas, as I said, shows that it is possible. It is not the one, but it is a scenario which kind of produces the observation. And whether it's correct or not, we have to let to know that one. But the bottom line is that if you have olivine basalt, which is copious on Mars, in fact, they find lots of olivine basalts on Mars, and if that one is about 30 kilometers thick, and has only 1% single domain magnetite, and it's magnetized at the 20,000 nanotesla, which is 1/3 of the core field of the Earth, that's enough for us to produce the magnetic anomalies. So it's not so much, and we don't look at the very, very different things, just the simple basalts, but should be volcanic and volcanically produced crust. Thank you very much. Well, we don't have it, unfortunately. One of the reasons is that magnetic anomalies that we are measuring, or we are looking at, is measured at 400 kilometer altitude. So the shortest wavelength is about 400 kilometers. So you don't see anything better than that. Therefore, it really cuts that far. And therefore, how many craters are there which produce the big ones? Those are what we looked at. We looked at about 19 craters. And none of them shows a very good demagnetization. Would have been good if you go on. One of the things that we are doing right now, by the way, to CSA as a concept study, we are suggesting that we put a nanosatellite on the Mars and measure the magnetic field at much closer. It's about 80 kilometer altitude. Then we will be able to understand if they go, that could give some idea about how we can degrade that one, see what's the depth. That's right. No, not really. What it makes is that you need only increase this one by a factor of two almost. You see, and that's 1%, 2% magnetizes is very easy to get in the corpuscles. In fact, we did see some evidence for core polar reversals. But we have seen that one, or suggestions.
Yeah. And therefore, you sort of erode the atmosphere very fast with this solar wind, which might have been orders of magnitude stronger.
Well,
I mean, it's linked. This magnetic field stuff is linked with the sustainability of more stronger atmosphere. And
yeah. Water and those are, even if it comes close to the surface, it may have no effect more than about a couple kilometers, even less, on the surface. But I have the core dynamo is the dynamo which is produced inside the center of the Mars.
But he's suggesting after the dynamo died,
yes,
there could be replications.
Yeah, that's what I want to say. No. But once the dynamo died, and we assume that this crust was formed and magnetized, now the magnetic field of the crust produced a very good shield for the solar wind. In fact, if you look at the magnetopoles of Mars, unlike Earth, which is very smooth like that, it just bumps like that. Each magnetic anomaly produces magnetic poles, so it doesn't really do any big effect on that.
Just one quick question from Tony Dada. It goes to great lengths to acquire vector data or three component vector data in many disciplines in use of it. And we decide very quickly to just work with all favorite components.
Yeah. Okay, that's right. Yes. There are two things. One is that NASA people looked at this very carefully, but they find out that due to the east-west currents in the ionosphere, east-west component is more contaminated by ionospheric currents. That's one thing. The other thing I did myself to satisfy myself, I looked at this, I took the radial component and produced a magnetic field of that or magnetic potential of that, then drive the east component and north component due to that magnetic potential and compare that one with the real data. Okay? The answer is that the real data is very close to that. Of course, there is a little bit noise there. So we have done that. In fact, there was my paper was published in 2004 called Coherent Model of that, because I took the radial but showed that the laterals also can be explained by this.
Single-wing grains or pseudo-single-wing grains, then logging temperature.
Yeah. Well, I was aware of that, and that's why I talked with David Dunlop lots. In fact, we published a paper on this together. And it says that at this range that I have taken for blocking temperature, between 580 to about 480, 100, is good enough. And if you go lower, you get titanomagnetites more than the single domain magnetite. That's what he said. But I take your point. And that basically means that viscosity magnetization may not be a very big factor.
But at an extremely fine range,
yes.
Like true signal, when you're down
in
the ten micron range,
yes.
Basically it
demagnetizes more than
time scales.
Yeah. But at what temperature? Okay.
To have it last a geological time, it has to be substantial size.
I take your point. I will look at that. But my feeling is just that the range that we have looked at it takes the basic things that we get in nature. Than the lab things. But it's a very good point.
Well,
I will look at that.
Very
That's right. But can we make those kind of very fine grain magnetic volcanic rocks? People doesn't say that. So, but I will look at it. That's a very good point. I will look at it. But
one last question.
Some of these hypothetical discussions, such as the one we just had,
I don't know. I tell you why, because it depends on what Bush wants to do. This is reality. I mean, that Mars was the most important thing until China wanted to go to the moon. As soon as China decided to go to the moon, Bush said that we have to go to the moon. Now, the whole of NASA has changed from Mars to moon right now. That's right. That's one way. But going back to what I am thinking, I think that within 2020, 2025, we'll be able to land there. We may not be able to bring the rocks, but we can land there and do some measurements there. Much better ways.
All we have to do is convince Bush that there's oil on Mars.
That's right. And there is lots.
Anyway, with that, let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.